When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
On the evening of February 11th, 2007, 33-year-old Jeremy Burt asked his father to look after his daughter Mackenzie. The two men lived together, and Jeremy explained that he was going to visit a friend to discuss hunting plans for the upcoming season. He drove off in his ex-wife Kim's car, a Mercury Cougar. He has never been seen again. Kim, with whom Jeremy was trying to rekindle their relationship, was in Las Vegas at the time, attending a seminar for work. By the next day, she began receiving a bizarre series of text messages from Jeremy's phone and allegedly typed by him, but none of them made sense. They claimed he was leaving, starting a new life, and that he would come back for his daughter, but that Kim should not try to contact him. It became clear that something was wrong and Jeremy was missing. No one had seen or heard from him, and for many, his ex-girlfriend and former lawyer, Jeannie Braun, was the most likely person of interest. When Jeremy left that night, he wasn't dressed as though he was going to a friend's house. According to his father, it seemed more likely he was planning a night out. But was he planning to see someone specific? In a bizarre turn of events, Kim got married not long after Jeremy vanished, a detail which sparked suspicion and has never been fully explained. Jeannie Braun claimed to have had no contact with Jeremy since her release from prison, despite witnesses stating otherwise, and police failed to act on the disappearance, arguing that Jeremy was an adult, and if he'd chosen to leave, as the texts claimed, there was little they could do. All of that would change 96 days after Jeremy vanished, when his ex-wife's car that he'd driven off in was discovered abandoned in a desolate area. The vehicle had been torched, and little remained beyond ashes and scorched steel. Our story picks up with the discovery of the car, and the Boise Police Department finally launching an official investigation, believing now that they had proof that foul play was involved. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 58, The Disappearance of Jeremy Burt, Part 2. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we revisit the disappearance of Jeremy Burt and conclude with Part 2. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcatcher. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at traceevpod. On Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, transcripts, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you'd like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. Where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. As a final note, I'll be making an appearance at a podcast meetup in Atlanta this October. The meetup will be comprised of other true crime podcasts, including The Fall Line, Moms and Murder, Corpus Delicti, and many more. The event will take place between 2 and 5 p.m. at the Thinking Man Tavern on Saturday, October 13th. For more information, visit trace-evidence.com, and I hope to see you there. As a final note, I wanted to thank all of you for the kindness and support you've given the show. From Patreon donations to amazing reviews and kind words on social media, you make doing this worth it, and it's your passion that helps drive me. Thanks to all of you amazing listeners, Trace Evidence recently passed 3 million downloads. That's a lot of new ears hearing these cases, and I'm grateful to all of you, so thank you. Today, I conclude the story of Jeremy Burt's disappearance. We'll pick up where we left off, with the discovery of the car, and move forward through the investigation, persons of interest, and a possible connection to the disappearance of another man. This is Episode 58, The Disappearance of Jeremy Burt, Part 2. On Friday, May 18th, some 3 months after Jeremy Burt was last seen, there was the first major break in the case, which would ultimately cause the Boise Police Department to launch a full-scale investigation into his disappearance. A man who was out on a cattle drive through the Bruno Desert, some 100 miles south of Boise, came upon a disturbing scene. Half a mile off a dirt track, over bumpy terrain, bushes and ditches, he saw what appeared to be the burned-out frame of a car. It wasn't an area which was easily accessible, and certainly not the kind of place you'd expect to find a car abandoned. When he was able to, the man placed a call to the sheriff's department, and they dispatched a unit to examine the scene. Upon arrival, it was clear that the vehicle had been almost completely consumed by the fire. The fire had burned incredibly hot, to the point that it gutted the car, leaving the frame and very few sections of painted exterior behind. One officer stated that even the license plates had been melted, but later interviews suggest the license plates were actually removed before the car was set on fire. The only way in which deputies were able to identify the vehicle was by the VIN number, which was still visible. Initially, they believed someone had burned the car for insurance purposes, or perhaps had stolen it and then disposed of the evidence. When they checked the VIN number in the system, though, it kicked back to them as Kim George's missing Mercury Cougar. The Boise Police Department was immediately notified. Bruno Dunes State Park is located in southwestern Idaho and covers a total of 4,800 acres. While there are certainly areas which are more inviting to those visiting the park, Jeremy's vehicle had been located in an area which was not so inviting. Beyond that, it was a question of how the vehicle came to rest there in the first place. It wasn't exactly the type of location people were known to drive to, and to come to this desolate spot required driving down a long dirt path and then veering off a half a mile and traversing difficult terrain. Suffice it to say, if one were looking to dispose of a vehicle in a location where it was unlikely to be located quickly, it would be difficult to find a more out-of-the-way place to do so. The vehicle was found approximately 45 miles from the Nevada state line, 100 miles away from Boise. Of course, the question of the fire raised a lot of theories. It didn't seem likely that Jeremy, were he planning to run off somewhere, would have destroyed the vehicle he planned to do so in. Investigators initially wondered if it were possible that he would have had an accomplice, someone who accompanied him to the site and later drove him elsewhere, but this didn't make a great deal of sense either. When the investigators from the Boise Police Department arrived on the scene, they were almost immediately suspicious. Their first act was to try and salvage any evidence from the remnants of the vehicle, and in order to do so, the ashes were filtered through a metal screen. Unfortunately, nothing was found which could assist investigators. The vehicle, though, was not fully processed. No fingerprints were taken, nor were there examinations for smaller pieces of forensic evidence. It seemed that the vehicle was believed to have been too extensively damaged to yield any results, though the choice not to process has been a point of contention in the years since. Detective Wodarki, when discussing the discovery of the car, stated, quote, "To me, if the plates have been removed and the car is burned like that, it could imply that someone's trying to dispose of evidence. To me personally, that definitely causes a lot of concern." End quote. Boise police, in conjunction with the sheriff's department, launched a search of the area surrounding the car. Using the vehicle as the center point, their search spanned out in a radius of 3 to 4 miles. Searchers were on foot, four-wheelers, and on horseback. The terrain is difficult and desolate, making it a large-scale search in a very barren location. Unfortunately, despite their efforts, nothing was located which they believed was connected to the vehicle or Jeremy. There have been subsequent searches, but nothing has ever been revealed as to whether or not evidence was uncovered. The discovery of the vehicle was both concerning and alarming to Jeremy's family. While on the one hand, it was positive that police had finally found something and that this discovery had pushed them to launch a full investigation, the condition of the vehicle and its location certainly suggested that something bad had happened. What could have happened, and who would have any reason to want to do something to Jeremy? There were, of course, certain names which made them suspicious, but overall, Jeremy wasn't in the habit of making a great deal of enemies. According to his father, Van, Jeremy had planned to go see a friend the night he vanished. That friend, Greg Reno, later told authorities that he was unaware that Jeremy would be coming, and he never saw him that night. So the question became, where did Jeremy go the night he vanished, and who might he have been going to see? In order to get a better understanding of Jeremy's activities that night, investigators pulled his cell phone and bank records. It was their hope to map out his travels on the night of February 11th, and hopefully, gain some insight into where he may have been going. Starting with financial records, there had been no activity on Jeremy's bank account since the night he had gone missing, but there were some clues as to his locations that evening. One debit card transaction took place at approximately 10:30 p.m. in Boise, shortly after Jeremy had told his father he was going out. The second transaction took place in the town of Mountain Home. A curious detail about this location is that Mountain Home is located approximately 30 minutes from Boise, and yet Jeremy's transaction there didn't take place until approximately midnight. Where had he been between 10:30 and midnight? It seemed unlikely that he'd been out to a bar or restaurant, as there was no evidence of a purchase, though it's also possible he could have had cash on him, but no witnesses reported seeing him that night. Detective Josiah Ransom, when asked about this, replied, quote, "There were charges on his card 40 to 45 minutes away, and then he veered off the face of the earth." End quote. According to Jeremy's friends and family, Mountain Home was not a location he frequented, and they couldn't think of anyone he may have known out that way. It was possible he could have done construction work there and had some familiarity with it, but it wasn't a place that rung any bells for anyone investigators asked about it. No one could fathom a reason why he'd have been there at that time of night. The entire city covers only 6 square miles with a population of around 14,000, not exactly a thriving town by comparison to Boise. Investigators began to wonder if Jeremy had planned to meet someone there, but they were never able to fully put their finger on the pulse of who that individual may have been or why Jeremy would have selected a late Sunday evening to arrange this get-together. Of course, the fact that Kim was out of town may have played a role in this. It's also important to note that Mountain Home sits between Boise and the Bruno Desert. The next option was to look closer at his cell phone records and see if they could help paint a more complete picture of what had gone on that evening. The phone records indicated something very suspicious to investigators. While there was nothing from the night he vanished which led them to any information, the phone had remained active for several days after he was last seen. Not only had the phone remained powered on, but a lot of calls were made over the course of the next few days. In total, from February 11th to 14th, there were a total of 36 phone calls. The majority of the calls were actually made to Jeremy's own number, implying that Jeremy, or whoever had come in possession of his cell phone, was checking his voicemail frequently. The calls which weren't made to the voicemail were listed on the record as being less than a minute in length, which suggests that these calls were placed to various numbers, and when the recipient answered, the caller hung up either after saying something very quickly or without saying anything at all. There was, though, one call which stood out as curious. On February 13th, 2 days after Jeremy vanished, a call was placed from Jeremy's phone to a payphone. This call lasted between 6 and 7 minutes, making it the longest call placed after Jeremy disappeared. What made it of even more interest to investigators was that the location of the payphone was in Mountain Home, the last town in which Jeremy is believed to have made a purchase. At approximately midnight, Jeremy's alleged to have purchased a drink and some snacks at a Chevron gas station. Sadly, when investigators arrive seeking answers, no one working had any memory of seeing Jeremy, and there were no surveillance cameras in place. While they now had a location tied to Jeremy, there was little else they could do. In an attempt to make connections to individuals who may have been in contact with Jeremy, or whoever was in possession of his phone, authorities started tracking down the owners of the numbers that had been called. Most of them were located, though they were unable to provide information regarding the disappearance. The final two numbers which had been on the list were no longer in service, and the owners of those numbers have never been identified. Police suggested it was possible that these numbers were connected to burner phones. A burner phone is typically a prepaid cell phone which an individual may use for suspicious activities, as it leaves no real paper trail and can be easily disposed of without leading back to the owner. Unfortunately, Jeremy's phone was not pinged at the time to try and triangulate locations as to where these calls were made from, and with all of the years that have passed, it's been suggested that pinging the phone is no longer possible. The next step for investigators was to take possession of Jeremy's laptop, which they wanted to sweep for any information which might show conversations he had, emails exchanged, or any evidence which might point them in a new direction. According to several people close to the investigation, retrieving the laptop wasn't exactly a quick process. It's been stated that Kim, who was in possession of Jeremy's laptop, seemed somewhat reluctant to hand it over to authorities. There's never been a definitive reason given for this hesitance, and while investigators have been fairly tight-lipped about a lot of the details surrounding this investigation, others have certainly implied that Kim wasn't fully cooperative at this time. There have even been rumors that Kim may have disposed of some of Jeremy's possessions shortly after his disappearance, which is odd to say the least, if true. Ultimately, detectives were given the laptop and they conducted multiple searches. On the laptop, police found a lot of recordings Jeremy had saved. These recordings included conversations with Kim, Jeannie Braun, and other individuals, but it was what wasn't found that caught their attention the most. Several audio files appeared to be missing. It's been suggested that Jeremy hid these files in plain sight. They were contained within a folder or multiple folders which, when you first saw them, suggested that it was something else entirely. The way someone might hide important audio or video files in a folder labeled receipts if you didn't want someone to know where to look. Details about the missing audio files has never been fully released, but it appears that the recordings established a timeline, and there were certain gaps in that timeline. Jeremy had left the laptop behind when he went out on February 11th, meaning that the only people who had unlimited access to it were his father, Van, and Kim, though neither admitted to removing any files from it. It's entirely possible Jeremy had removed the files himself for one reason or another, though Kim's reluctance to hand over the computer did make investigators suspicious. At this time, police made the decision that in order to try and clear things up and to focus in more intently on suspicious individuals, they wanted to do a round of polygraph tests. How many people were tested is unknown. Publicly, it's been said that many people were, but we know of three individuals for certain. Kim George, Jeremy's ex-wife and girlfriend at the time of his disappearance, his father, Van, and his former lawyer and girlfriend, Jeannie Braun. Both Kim and Van have publicly stated that they passed their polygraphs, while Braun has never publicly discussed the results. The Boise police, for their part, have never commented on the results of these tests and have neither confirmed nor denied that both Kim and Van passed, let alone made any specific comments about Braun's results. When Braun spoke to police, she told them that she hadn't had contact with Jeremy for months. She claimed that the last time they'd had contact was before he testified against her, though multiple witnesses have disputed that fact and made it clear that, upon her release from prison, Braun was showing up in Jeremy's life again. At the time, authorities were growing frustrated as everything seemed to lead them to a dead end. They weren't gaining information from interviews. Whatever results the polygraphs yielded didn't seem to push them into new areas, and no one was coming forward with any new statements. Jeremy couldn't have merely vanished, and it was clear that someone knew what happened to him, but no one was providing the necessary details. Without a clear person of interest, everyone became a suspect. Detective Wodarki later said, quote, "Anybody who knew Jeremy is a person of interest at this point. We have talked to every person that we have located so far that had any kind of knowledge of Jeremy. We tried to talk to them, and so far, all of those conversations have led us nowhere." End quote. For many, including Jeremy's family, their top person of interest was Jeannie Braun. The former lawyer certainly had reasons to want revenge against Jeremy. It was his recordings and testimony which had played a major role in her conviction and disbarring. While she denied any connection to him following the trial, it seemed apparent that this wasn't entirely true. The fact that Jeremy had gotten dressed up the night he vanished implied that he may have been going to meet someone other than a friend, with whom he was supposedly planning to discuss hunting. Was it possible that Jeremy had made plans to meet with Braun that night? Many believe this was the case, and either something went wrong, or he may have been lured into a trap. Over the years, many have dug into this connection, and a lot of curious details have been revealed that connect Jeremy to Braun, and Braun to another missing person. Shortly after Kim's car had been found burned in the Bruno Desert, Braun's former assistant, Shannon, whom she planned to frame for her own criminal activities, received a disturbing phone call. At the time, Shannon had gotten out of the law business and was working as a real estate agent. The phone call came from a man who expressed an interest in looking at a house that was for sale. What first caught Shannon off guard was that the call had come in the evening, and usually the showing of a house was a daytime activity. The caller wanted Shannon to come out and give him access to the home so he could take a look around. Shannon got frightened when she realized the home was near the Bruno Desert, and with the discovery of the car fresh in her mind, she began to wonder if it was possible that the man on the phone might be connected to it. He sounded familiar, and it was later implied that it may have been a man named Mike Cook. Interestingly, Cook just happened to live in the town of Bruno. Cook was an associate of Braun's, and Shannon had some knowledge of him. There isn't a great amount of information available about Cook, but what has been stated publicly alleges that he was involved in crimes and was a violent individual. It was his connection to Braun which disturbed Shannon the most. Braun had wanted to frame Shannon for her crimes, and Shannon knew about it. After Braun's release from prison, she believed it was possible that she was plotting revenge against her. Though there has never been any evidence revealed to confirm this, Shannon had implied she believed Braun may have been stalking her after her release. With the car having been found in Bruno, and now this man trying to get Shannon to come out there at night, she made the wise decision to terminate the phone call. She never did receive a follow-up call about this house, and while she believed the man on the phone was Cook, she couldn't say this with 100% certainty. Braun's own history makes her suspicious to many. While she had spent time in jail for forgery, it was hardly her first brush with the law. In the past, she had been charged with discharging a firearm, as well as claims that she assaulted her assistant. In part one, I had discussed that just weeks after Jeremy had gone missing, Kim had gotten remarried. This was certainly a strange thing which, to this day, lacks enough information to completely understand, but she wasn't the only woman in Jeremy's life to move on quickly. On February 14th, just 3 days after the last time he was seen, Braun became engaged. You might wonder who she became engaged to. Well, that would be none other than Mike Cook. While they were never married, they seemed to have continued a connection long after their engagement broke off. When Braun later married an older man, a lawyer named Mike Hughes, who she'd met on a sugar daddy's website, their marriage became a volatile situation, and Braun later accused him of assault. Hughes claimed that Braun was the aggressor, and he also had a lot of other information that he felt was strange. It was Hughes' contention that Braun received packages, he believed from Mike Cook, and those packages he thought contained burner phones. Whether or not this is true, there's really no way to know for sure as the packages were never checked. But Hughes was relieved after divorcing Braun and having her removed from his life, but it did come at quite a cost. Hughes pled guilty and served a week in jail after it was claimed that he'd pointed a gun at Braun, though he contended that she had threatened him with it, and he pled guilty only to make the charges lesser. When Braun was getting involved in law, her mentor was a woman named Constance Malman Norris. As the two grew to know one another, they struck up a close friendship, and that friendship plays a vital role in connecting Jeremy's disappearance to another Boise man's vanishing, Aaron Barnard. As mentioned in part one, Jeremy knew Aaron to some degree, as while he was spending time with Braun, Aaron was dating Constance. The two spent time together at Braun's assistant's wedding, on a double date, though it's never been established whether or not Jeremy and Aaron struck up much of a friendship. There was some implied connection, with some believing that Jeremy may have done roofing work for Aaron, though that has never been confirmed. For many, it's a bit much of a coincidence to accept that Braun could have a relationship with Jeremy, who later disappeared, while also having a connection to Aaron. Most people in life rarely know anyone who disappears, let alone knowing two men living in the same area who disappeared within 2 years of each other. It becomes even more difficult to swallow when each is the ex-boyfriend of this set of friends. Aaron's case is as complicated, if not more so, than Jeremy's, and while I may examine it in long form in the future, I can't do so right now. But I do think it's important to address some background details here, as they may play a role in revealing possibilities in connection to Jeremy's disappearance. Aaron's relationship with Constance was somewhat surprising to those in his life. At the time, she was far older than him, and while Aaron was a smart man, no one expected him to end up dating a woman so much his senior. How the two connected is unsure, though it's been suggested that Aaron may have been seeking legal counsel for a custody issue, at which point he met Constance. Their relationship was, by all accounts, not the greatest, and it certainly wasn't long-lasting. Aaron had been quite the entrepreneur throughout his life and had run many businesses, including a fish shop and a gun store. He had plans to open a motorcycle shop, and Constance ultimately came in as a partner. The relationship revolving around this shop created a great deal of tension between the two, and one day, without Aaron's knowledge or approval, Constance turned around and sold the shop out from under him.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
According to Aaron's mother, he never received any payment in relation to this sale, and Constance had not only sold the shop, but also many of Aaron's personal belongings located inside the shop, such as tools and display cases. Aaron, however, didn't learn about the sale until he arrived for work one day and found the locks had been changed. There was later an altercation between Aaron and Constance, which resulted in a battery charge against Aaron. Constance claimed that Aaron had gotten physically violent with her, though Aaron said that Constance had tried to throw a cell phone at him and he'd grabbed her wrist to stop her from doing so. Apparently, discussion of the shop and money owed to him led to this dispute, and Aaron wanted to know why Constance had, essentially, stolen his business. While his relationship with Constance was obviously a very problematic situation, those looking into a possible connection to Jeremy Burt have often wondered, could there be something which connects Aaron more closely to Jeannie Braun? According to several people, there was a connection. As previously mentioned, Braun had been charged with discharging a firearm, and it's been alleged that this weapon was loaned to her by Aaron. In addition to this, while it's hotly disputed, many have suggested that Braun approached Aaron in much the same way she had approached Jeremy, asking him to lie and say that her assistant, Shannon, had admitted to the forgery charge for which Braun later pled guilty. It's been said that Aaron told her no and then informed a lawyer about the conversation, but Aaron himself did not take part in the trial. The word is, though, that Aaron was involved in a separate legal matter involving Braun previously. The battery charge from his encounter with Constance was still hanging over his head in December of 2004, when he vanished under what can only be described as a bizarre set of circumstances. Aaron owned his own home and had been renting a room out to a friend. According to witness statements, Aaron approached this friend and told him that, unfortunately, he was going to need for him to move out as he owed someone a favor and was going to rent the room to another person. There didn't appear to be any animosity there, and shortly thereafter, a man named Tyler moved in. Aaron's mother has expressed that she didn't know Tyler previously, and wasn't sure how Aaron had come to know him, nor who the friend was that he had met Tyler through. She did, however, explain that, not long after Tyler had moved in, Aaron became suspicious that he may have been stealing from him, and he began concealing items of value. On December 4th, 2004, Aaron had plans to meet with a friend whom he hadn't seen in a long time. At the time, Aaron was in custody of his son and wanted to make arrangements for him to be taken care of that evening. Knowing that his son was exceptionally shy, he didn't want to bring in a babysitter, and so he spoke with the child's mother and arranged to meet her at their usual spot for exchanging the child, the McDonald's, located at Cole Road and Overland Road in Boise. Aaron arrived and dropped off his son at approximately 7 p.m. The two made plans for Aaron to pick his son up the next morning to finish off his weekend, but Aaron would never arrive, and this would be the last time anyone confirmed seeing him. Within the next 15 minutes, Aaron spoke to a friend and neighbor on his way home. The two live very close to each other, and Aaron made mention that he was just passing by her house, which meant that he was nearly home. While the two were talking, someone else began beeping in on the call, and Aaron switched over. When he came back to the original call, he explained that his roommate, Tyler, had called and needed him to come home right away. He didn't seem to know why Tyler needed him there so quickly or what the issue was, but this was the last time anyone had contact with Aaron, and it took place at approximately 7:15 p.m. Aaron never called his friend back, nor answered his phone again. When his mother tried to get in touch with him, she received no answer, and has expressed multiple times that this simply wasn't Aaron's usual behavior. Even if he was busy and couldn't talk, he'd answer and say so. It was extremely unlike him to allow calls to get to his voicemail, but it was even more unlike him to fail to pick up his son the next day. When Aaron's mother contacted the police to report him missing, she was met with a very similar response that Jeremy's family had been. He was an adult. If he wanted to leave without telling anyone, he was free to do so. The problem was, much like with Jeremy, Aaron had a child who he loved and was supposed to be spending time with. He was extremely close with his mother and never went for days without speaking to her, and when police agreed to do a welfare check, they discovered a bizarre inconsistency. While Aaron's roommate Tyler claimed that Aaron never made it home that night, his car was parked in the driveway. Police stated they found no signs of foul play in the home and nothing to indicate that a crime had been committed. Sadly, for Aaron's mother, she went through a brutal back and forth with the police before finally receiving the help she so desperately needed. Much like Jeremy's case, it took quite a while before an investigation was launched into his disappearance. With more similarities to Jeremy's disappearance, there has been little, if any, information discovered in the years since. Polygraphs have been given, items which belonged to Aaron were found in the possession of others, and someone, at some point, broke into his home and accessed his crawl space, where his mother speculated that Aaron had kept guns, valuables, and cash. Bizarrely, when he first was reported missing, police mentioned the battery charge and even suggested the possibility that Aaron may have been a drug dealer. While the charge of battery was later dropped and the statement about him selling drugs was erased, it may have done irreparable damage to the early stages of trying to locate him. So what ties Aaron's disappearance to Jeremy's? Firstly, the sheer fact that these two men associated with one another through Jeannie Braun is enough to raise suspicions for many. There has been rumor that after both Aaron and Jeremy refused to participate in Braun's plan to frame her assistant, that she may have tried to get another man to sign an affidavit stating that both men were drug dealers, allegedly in an attempt to undermine their credibility should they be called to testify against her. Jeremy does mention Aaron in at least one of the recordings found on his laptop, though details about what exactly was said have been limited. The most compelling reason, though, may be something Jeremy is alleged to have said after his disappearance. It's been reported that Jeremy made a statement to both Kim and Shannon at different times, where he referenced Aaron's disappearance and suggested that, should anything happen to him, if he should happen to disappear, it would not be by his own choice. Whether or not there's a direct link between both men's disappearances remains unknown, and while many believe that Braun either played a role in Jeremy's disappearance or possesses more information about what may have happened, it's yet to be proven. For Aaron, Braun and Constance remain the subject of conjecture and debate, though so does his former roommate Tyler. Many believe the answers are there, but the puzzle doesn't have enough pieces to fully provide the clear picture of what happened in either case. Aaron has been missing for nearly 14 years, and if alive, would be 48 years old today. Hope, though, has slowly faded over those years, and his mother, Vicky, has expressed her belief that foul play was involved and it's likely that someone murdered her son. Jeremy's disappearance as well remains a complex story with too many questions and not enough answers. In hopes of finding the truth, his family hired a private investigator, Marky Davis, who has dug deep and turned up possible connections, but nothing solid enough yet to establish what may have happened. Initially, Boise investigators weren't interested in allowing Davis access to the files, but in 2014, 7 years after Jeremy vanished, they finally agreed to allow her to work on the case. Davis has done a lot of hard work and believes that Jeremy was the victim of foul play. Unfortunately, the evidence simply hasn't been discovered, and the mystery still haunts the Burt family. During the course of her investigation, she became aware of Aaron's case and has done work on it as well, believing that there's a great likelihood that the two disappearances are connected. In the years since Jeremy vanished, his family has struggled to come to terms with the loss. His daughter, Mackenzie, has grown up without her father and without answers. She maintains a relationship with the family, but it's clear to all that Jeremy's absence resounds with a painful thud. How is it possible that after so many years, nothing new has been discovered, and no one has come forward with something to lead both of these families to some form of relief? Aaron's mother received an anonymous letter which suggested a possibility, though it remains unproven. For the Burt family, they have received little to assuage their grief and answer their questions. 2 years after Davis was hired on by the family, a tragic event took place which stirred up old feelings and made many who have followed this case wonder if there was a connection. Kim George, who was married shortly after Jeremy vanished, had later divorced her husband. She moved forward with her life, raising Mackenzie, and later married another man with whom she had a second daughter. While details are scarce, as is often the case in regard to such a heartbreaking incident, Kim George died on July 4th, 2016, the victim of an apparent suicide. It's impossible to know what may have led to this, and while some have speculated that years of grief and pain in regard to Jeremy's disappearance may have played a role, others believe it may be a sign of something more sinister. With the way events turned out, we may never know. Kim expressed a great deal of sorrow over the fact that Mackenzie would grow up without her father, and now, sadly, she is raised by her stepfather with both of her biological parents gone. Another devastating blow to an already fragile and mournful family. It's been 11 years since Jeremy Burt was last seen, and despite the efforts of his family, the Boise Police Department, and private investigator Marky Davis, his case remains a frustrating and heartbreaking mystery. In the absence of solid evidence, three main theories have arisen to provide possibilities of what may have happened to Jeremy. The first theory suggests that Jeremy may have been the victim of a random act of violence, either by a total stranger or perhaps someone he knew. Supporters of this theory argue that the reason no connections have ever been made to anyone who has been looked at with suspicion is because this crime may not be connected to them. Some believe that Jeremy may have been carjacked, or perhaps attacked by someone or a group of suspects at random. Or, there's the possibility that the person responsible for this crime may have been involved in Jeremy's life, but has simply never crossed the radar of investigators. The second theory puts forth the possibility that Jeremy's disappearance could be connected to one of the women in his life, namely Kim George. For many, her behavior in regard to his laptop and the speed with which she married another man could imply that she had something to hide and may have been involved in something behind Jeremy's back. For others, the manner in which Kim died suggests that she may have felt incredible guilt about something, or possess knowledge of something which she struggled to deal with until the point that she could no longer process it. The third and final theory, which is by far the leading and most popular theory in this case, is that Jeannie Braun, Jeremy's former lawyer and girlfriend, played a role in his disappearance. Many believe that Braun participated in this crime either as a direct act of revenge for Jeremy's participation in the trial, which led to her being disbarred and serving time. Others believe that Braun may have been engaging in a relationship with Jeremy at the time of his disappearance, and due to her volatile and violent nature, as shown in previous court cases, may have lashed out at Jeremy and may have murdered him, covering it up and later using her legal knowledge to send out text messages in hopes of delaying police investigation. A Navy veteran with a passion for the outdoors and an unstoppable love for his daughter, Jeremy's disappearance has been one of the most complex, confusing, and haunting stories amongst the quantity of unsolved Idaho cold cases. If alive today, Jeremy Burt would be 45 years old. When last seen, Jeremy was described as being a Caucasian male, standing approximately 6 foot 2 inches tall and weighing 197 pounds. He has brown hair and hazel eyes. Jeremy has a scar on his knee and a 2-inch scar on the left side of his chest. At the time of his disappearance, he had a goatee and was last seen wearing a dark-colored turtleneck and Levi's jeans. He was last known to have been in the area of Boise and Mountain Home, Idaho. 11 years ago, 33-year-old Jeremy Burt kissed his daughter, told his father he'd be back later, walked out of his apartment, and was never seen again. In the years since, Mackenzie has grown up without a father, and the Burt family has been absolutely crushed by their missing son, brother, and cousin. They have moved forward with their lives, but each holiday, each birthday, each day, they wonder what happened to him and hope that someday they will have an answer. They have had rallies, fundraisers, and done all they can to raise awareness for his story, all the while knowing that out there, somewhere, someone knows exactly what happened.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Jeremy Burt was a hardworking man and a dedicated father. His love life was, for lack of a better term, complicated. And for many, his disappearance likely has some connection to it. His relationship with Kim, even before meeting Jeannie Braun, was described by friends and family as being a matter of extremes. There was intense love, and there was also intense dispute. It seems clear that these two were people who cared for one another, but also struggled to get along. Braun's arrival in their lives set off a lot of things and caused a lot of complications, but by the time Jeremy was last seen, it appeared as though they may have been finding their way back together. Of course, that's a matter of who you ask. Whereas Kim openly expressed that they were happy, others have implied that things may not have been exactly what they'd seemed. It appears the closer you look, the more complicated this story becomes. The disappearance of Jeremy Burt is a complicated case with a lot of different angles to it. What initially appears to be the story of a man who went out one night and failed to return home quickly becomes about anger, betrayal, revenge, and the possibilities in terms of suspects or people who may have had a reason to strike out against Jeremy. When I first examined this case, based on the stories I'd read and the shows I'd watched, it seemed more cut and dry. It wasn't until I dug deeper that I found a lot of the coverage was shallow. In the past week, since the release of episode 1, the most common comment I've received has been that someone watched the Disappeared episode and was surprised by how much information wasn't touched on. Sadly, that isn't all that uncommon, but in Jeremy's case, there's a lot of moving parts here. The problem is, no matter how many angles you find, no matter how many details you uncover, at its core, this is the story of a kind and caring father, a supportive brother, a loving son, who was needlessly taken away, and whoever is responsible has lived the past 11 years without having to pay for their crime. For whatever reason, coverage of this case is fairly narrow. While I was able to find a lot of news articles and a few television shows that touched on it, they all tend to have the same bend to them. That may not make them wrong, but it's interesting how there's one theory about this case which most people seem to agree with, and while that theory may indeed be likely, focusing solely on that angle forces you to dismiss other pieces of information which may lead in other directions. Today, I'm going to examine three theories which have been suggested. The first theory opens up the possibility that Jeremy's disappearance may be related to a stranger, or perhaps someone in Jeremy's life who has never been considered a suspect. We know that Jeremy left his apartment sometime between 10 and 10:30 p.m. on February 11th. According to his bank records, he made a purchase around 10:30 in Boise and then another at midnight in Mountain Home. The fact that he bought snacks and a drink has always implied to me the possibility that he was going to be on his way home, as you typically wouldn't buy this kind of stuff if you were going to meet someone. Unless, of course, that someone was located far away. Would Jeremy have been heading out on a long drive at midnight, or is it more likely that he was going to be heading back towards Boise and was ending his evening with something to eat and drink for the ride? It's hard to say, but knowing that he had Mackenzie at home and he told his father he'd be back, it never made a lot of sense to me that he was then going off on some long haul. Regardless of who Jeremy may have had plans with, or what he intended to do, it's unlikely he'd be doing something which would have cut into his time with Mackenzie the next day. Yes, he left while she was home, but she was asleep, and so it seems he figured he'd be back before she woke up. It would be great if we had any idea who Jeremy may have had plans with that night, if any at all. His friend, Greg, who he claimed he was going to visit, has said that while he didn't see Jeremy that night, he did have a missed call from him, and it's possible Jeremy had stopped by while he was sleeping. The call makes me believe, at least in part, Jeremy did plan to see Greg that night. It's a question of where he was going after that, if he was meeting someone else or just going out for a night on the town. Following the latter idea first, Jeremy could have run into anyone between Boise and Mountain Home. Whether this be someone looking to commit a carjacking, someone looking for trouble, or someone who had ill intent specifically when it came to Jeremy. Another important thing to bear in mind is, while I've discussed the purchase of a snack and drink, that doesn't necessarily confirm it was Jeremy who bought those items. A debit card can be used like a credit card, in which case you don't need someone's PIN number to utilize it. Employees didn't remember seeing Jeremy that night, though it had been months since he vanished when they were finally questioned. We know that his cell phone was used to make a call to a payphone in Mountain Home, which seems to imply that someone involved in Jeremy's disappearance either lived in or was familiar with Mountain Home. There must be some connection there, and sadly, we just don't know why Jeremy would have been there in the first place. Perhaps he was meeting someone there, or someone forced him to go there, but then again, that doesn't make sense when you follow the theory to include him buying snacks. Unless whoever was involved hadn't revealed their full intentions yet. One angle of this which is fascinating is, In terms of purchasing the drink and food for a longer drive, the drive from Mountain Home to the car's final location in the Bruno Desert isn't exactly a short one. Is it possible that Jeremy simply ran across a person or persons who were looking for trouble? Absolutely. Maybe they wanted to carjack. Maybe they wanted his card and PIN number to access his bank account, though if that was their intent, they failed. Then again, what's the purpose of carjacking someone? Usually it's to part out the vehicle and make some money, not to drive it down to the desert and set it on fire. The desert angle is also interesting because it seems like you wouldn't be willing to drive into that desolate area and set your transportation on fire unless two other factors were involved: someone to drive you out of there, and a working knowledge of the Bruno Desert. You'd also think that there'd be some familiarity and knowledge of the fact that the vehicle was unlikely to be found if left there. In terms of this being an act conducted by someone that Jeremy knew, whether he knew them well or not, we have to look at motive. For what reason could someone want Jeremy to disappear? Perhaps a dispute over money, or an issue regarding a personal matter, but you'd have to believe if something like that existed, it seems highly unlikely that this issue wouldn't have been caught on at least one of the recordings on Jeremy's computer. He kept track of a lot, even innocuous conversations, so it seems silly to imagine that he wouldn't have kept track of a situation that could have been dangerous. Of course, some recordings are believed to have been missing, but that would imply someone with access to the computer was involved, or Jeremy removed them himself, which makes it a very different story. Ultimately, while it's entirely possible this crime was committed by a stranger, or someone Jeremy didn't know well, it also feels unlikely. Would this person have simply run into Jeremy and then decided to act? If this person attempted to lure him out, would Jeremy be willing to meet this person if it wasn't someone he knew very well, late at night? This theory cannot be officially ruled out, but in the grand scheme of things, it appears more likely that whoever played a role in Jeremy's disappearance had a stronger connection with him. One detail which has always made me highly suspicious of the possibility that this was a crime committed by a total stranger or someone Jeremy kinda knew are the texts. If the goal was to get rid of Jeremy, for whatever reason, why would this person hang onto his phone and send out those text messages? Also, of all the people to choose to send them to, why would you select Kim? We know based on one of the text messages that the person sending them knew Jeremy well enough to use a phrase he often used in reference to his daughter, which seems to knock out the possibility of a total stranger altogether. Could it have been someone he knew? Perhaps, but in that regard, two names are the most commonly considered. This leads us to the second theory, which would be that Kim George was somehow involved in Jeremy's disappearance. Starting at the beginning, we know their relationship wasn't exactly without issue. The two had a relationship which was good when it was good, but really bad when it was bad. They'd been through a lot together, had been around each other for a long time, and certainly had plenty of time and opportunity to grow close, but also to develop grudges. Jeremy had cheated on Kim with Braun, and while she suspected it at first, he later confirmed it. That's not an easy pill to swallow, and it certainly opens the door to the possibility that Kim may have wanted revenge. Things were constantly changing, though. Both Kim and Jeremy loved Mackenzie, and she seemed to be a permanent bond which would unite them. At the time of the disappearance, the two had been working on putting the pieces back together, and Kim later claimed that they were both happy and excited about the direction they were heading. While that statement at first seems direct, there are two events which seem to contradict it. Firstly, Jeremy got dressed up and went out that night. Even his father has implied he considered the possibility that Jeremy was either going out to a party or that he may have planned on seeing a woman. Kim felt Jeremy hadn't been cheating because he never went anywhere, but the fact that the first night she was out of town matches up with the first time he's going out is a little bit more than suspicious. On top of that, we know that Kim got married within a short time frame after Jeremy disappeared. That would have to be a hell of a whirlwind romance, as you'd imagine that she'd be upset, hurt, and trying to find answers as to what happened to her former husband and, at the time, boyfriend. Sure, it's possible she met a friend of Jeremy's and they bonded over their grief, but why would they end up married that quickly? It didn't make sense to me then, and it doesn't make sense to me now. I know people often rush into marriages, but within weeks of someone's disappearance? That's always been remarkably shady to me, and to most people who examine this case. Is it possible that Kim was involved with this man previously, and may have been seeing him behind Jeremy's back? Absolutely. Remember, revenge is a dish best served cold. It's important to note that almost every detail we have about the status of Kim and Jeremy's relationship at the time he vanished comes from Kim's mouth. She is the one who set the stage and depicted the events, she's the one who claimed that things were going well, and she was thinking about getting her ring back. Kim later claimed that she wanted Jeremy to come visit her in Vegas, which never made sense because it was a long drive. He had Mackenzie, and if she'd wanted him to come along, why wouldn't he have been flying down with her? Others, though, have told the story the opposite way. According to several people close to the case, it was Jeremy who wanted to go see Kim, and she refused, saying that she'd be busy and he'd have nothing to do. Yeah, a man in Las Vegas would certainly find it hard to keep busy during the day. The fact of the matter is, when it comes to the Vegas trip, we can't know for sure what was going on there. However, if you had a plan in place which would result in the disappearance of your ex-husband, it sure supplies a hell of an alibi. Who first became aware that something was wrong? Kim. Who received the text message saying that Jeremy was leaving? Not his mother. Not his brother. Not the cousin who was his best friend. Not the father who was watching his daughter. It was Kim who got the messages. And while they led to her being suspicious about what was going on, they also added extra support to a probable alibi. She couldn't possibly be involved if these texts disturbed her and caused her to reach out to others, but how disturbed can you be if you wait to come home a week later before you do anything about it? Sadly, considering the way things ended for Kim, these are answers we may never have. It's impossible to rule it all out, though. Her behavior was, for lack of a better term, suspicious. She was out of town, received the texts, filed the missing persons report, and the report about her car being stolen. It all appears to be the things a person would do if they were genuinely concerned. But at the same time, these actions are contradicted by odd behaviors. She allegedly threw out some of Jeremy's belongings. She was reluctant to turn over his laptop, and she got married pretty damn quick. Nothing makes sense when it comes to this, and from everything I've seen, Kim didn't participate in much of the activities revolving around trying to drum up publicity for the case. Yeah, she appeared on the episode It Disappeared, but the show has a history of tilting narratives when it comes to the people who agree to be on the show. Almost none of Kim's suspicious behavior was mentioned on that show. Would it have been had she not agreed to participate? It's hard to say for sure. One detail we know for a fact is that even after Kim and Jeremy were working things out, he was still recording his conversations with her. This has been suggested to have been related to protection, in case there was ever a dispute about Mackenzie's custody. If you were working things out with your ex, and they were going so well, would you find it necessary to do this? Maybe Jeremy was simply the paranoid type. Or maybe there are facts of this story we simply don't know. Maybe he had a reason to believe something was wrong, or that he might need these recordings for protection in the future. Is it possible Jeremy suspected that Kim was seeing someone else, or that he wanted to see someone else and knew things would get bad when he told Kim? Again, we have no way of knowing, but when everything is laid out on the table and you start to do the math, there's something about Jeremy and Kim's relationship and her actions following his disappearance which simply don't make sense. Kim was supposedly aware that Braun had come back around after her release from prison. Kim claimed that Jeremy told her the truth about it and that he had told Braun to stay away, but others suspected Jeremy was seeing his former lawyer again. Kim may have become aware of this and been outraged. She may have decided that she was going to leave and to try and take back custody of Mackenzie. A million things may have happened that we simply don't know about, but no matter how you slice it, this is a theory which carries some weight. Everyone immediately points a finger at Braun, and there's certainly plenty of reason to do so that I'll get into later, but that often results in Kim being ignored. It's a terrible thing that Kim took her own life in July of 2016, and there's a myriad of things which could have led up to it. We don't know a great amount of details about her life after Jeremy, any mental illnesses or medication she may have been on, but it did make a lot of people suspicious. Could she have been guilty about something? Could she have been overwrought with the emotional battles she'd been dealing with? Perhaps, but we may never know. While I don't believe Kim's untimely death necessarily connects to Jeremy, I do believe that when all the pieces of this puzzle are put together, there's a lot of questions about her which have never been answered. It's entirely possible that Kim was distraught over what happened, that she loved Jeremy, that she played no role in his disappearance, and that she made some of her choices out of desperation, but it's difficult to ignore some of these questions. This brings us to the final theory, the most popular one, the name that comes up the most when you look into this case and ask who may have been responsible, Jeannie Braun. Much of what we know about Braun is unflattering, to say the least. She has a criminal history that includes discharging a firearm, an accusation of assault, and a guilty plea for forgery. The forgery charge was what ultimately led to Braun losing her license to practice law and her time in jail. Much of the reason she pled guilty was because of Jeremy's testimony and his recordings. So why would this woman, who lost her livelihood and spent time in jail because of Jeremy, get released and immediately want to bring their relationship back together? Even more so than that, why would Jeremy elect to be around her? He was far from a stupid man, and it makes little sense to trust Braun. She tried to get him to commit perjury. She had shown she was capable of criminal actions. So is it possible he was still seeing her? Of course it's possible. Men aren't often known to make the best decisions when they involve an attractive woman, and especially one for whom you once had feelings. Jeremy was a big man. He'd been trained in the Navy through the SEAL program. There's a good chance that he figured there wasn't much Braun could do to him physically. In terms of manipulation or blackmail, he had recordings, so it didn't seem like Braun would be able to do anything in that regard either. At the same time, Braun would now be aware of Jeremy's recording habit, and she'd be suspicious of him. This is a very bizarre relationship, and it's hard to wrap your head around the possibility that Jeremy would have been open to spending time with her. But several people believe that's exactly what was happening. Is it possible that the night Jeremy went missing, he was planning to see Braun? Absolutely. Kim was out of town, Braun was available, and there's a chance this may have been a plan. No communications have been found connecting the two on that night, but perhaps they had a way of transmitting this type of information without being tracked. Or perhaps Jeremy would have communicated with Braun through someone else, or through a burner phone which couldn't be tracked. Either way, when you examine the case, Braun seems to be the individual most people feel had the greatest reason for wanting revenge against Jeremy. Jeremy's car was found in the Bruno Desert. Braun is associated with a man, Mike Cook, who lived in the town of Bruno. That's a difficult coincidence to ignore. Braun allegedly became engaged to this man just 3 days after Jeremy vanished, which may or may not imply either a strong connection that was formed, or perhaps an attempt to preempt legal procedures by granting spousal privilege, in which case a person cannot be forced to testify against their spouse. As a former lawyer, Braun would have a great wealth of knowledge which would lend the ability to cover this crime up if she were involved. Many believe that the texts sent to Kim were the result of someone knowing that when the police saw these texts, in which it was claimed that Jeremy was running off, they would react by acknowledging that as an adult, he had the right to go as he pleased. This certainly delayed their investigative response, and Braun would know this as well. As someone who had been around Jeremy, who had been intimate with him, it isn't hard to imagine she may have been aware of the phrase Jeremy used when referring to Mackenzie, which would definitely make it seem more like he was the one sending the texts. Perhaps choosing Kim as the recipient played a double role, to both cover up the crime and to taunt the woman who had come between Braun and Jeremy. It isn't difficult to imagine that Braun could have, if indeed she was seeing Jeremy, arranged to meet him somewhere where he may have been attacked. Yes, he was physically fit and well-trained, but if it was an ambush, he'd have no way to prepare for it. Imagine a scenario in which he arrives someplace to spend time with Braun, and another man is there, perhaps brandishing a weapon. I'd imagine Jeremy would fight, but if it were a remote enough location, there wouldn't be many witnesses around to notice. The disposal of the car in the Bruno Desert certainly implies that it was done by someone who knew the area, was aware that it would be easy to conceal things there, and who would know that area better than someone who lived in Bruno, like Mike Cook? When you begin connecting the dots, there's a lot here which makes Braun appear highly suspicious. Of course, there are details which detract from this. Of all the times to commit this crime, why do it on this particular day? If Jeremy and Braun were still seeing one another, surely there were other opportunities. Perhaps it did revolve around Kim being out of town, or maybe it was difficult to see one another if she was there. Another issue is that, while Braun is certainly connected to criminal activities, she hasn't yet been attached to a murder, at least not in any way which can be proved. Many people consider Braun may have played a role in Aaron Barnard's disappearance, or perhaps had knowledge of it through her association with Constance, but that's the only time that comes up. She's lashed out, she's assaulted, she's lied and forged documents, but she hadn't yet been proven to be a killer. That doesn't mean she isn't one, but you'd imagine if you're a cutthroat lawyer with a high level of intelligence and you played a role in Aaron's disappearance, wouldn't you be hesitant to do it again with Jeremy? Maybe, but at the same time, if you're power-hungry enough and you got away with it once, it may open the door to believing you can get away with it again. Braun's future husband believed that she and Mike Cook were still in contact and exchanging packages, which may have been burner phones. While this is possible, there doesn't seem to be much of an explanation as to why this would be done unless they were communicating about crimes or keeping track of the progress in relation to a crime they'd committed. Cook eventually moved away from Idaho, going to Alaska, though he did return later. Braun left the state and married a man in Utah. At this particular time, I haven't found any information as to where she may be living, or who with, but there's been nothing said about her being back in Idaho, and it's unknown whether or not she continues communication with Mike Cook. Braun is certainly a suspect worthy of second, third, fourth, fifth looks. There's a lot of information here which lends a great deal of suspicion to her. We don't know the results of her polygraph, and while they aren't the most trustworthy tests, one would be inclined to believe that, had she failed, she'd likely have been questioned by authorities many times. Then again, being a former lawyer, she also likely has lawyer friends and knows how to keep her mouth shut. We don't know exactly how much she was looked into, but being that almost everyone who looks into this case considers her a prime suspect, it'd be difficult to imagine she wasn't extensively examined as a possibility. It's impossible to deny Braun's connection to Jeremy, the fact that she would have a motive, and her connection to others who may have been involved, such as Mike Cook. While it appears there is less evidence linking her to Aaron Barnard, the possibilities in terms of Jeremy are almost undeniable. For those of you who have been listening to my podcast for a while, you know I work very hard to present both sides of a story, to give you reasons why someone may be guilty and reasons why they may not be. I have never had this difficult of a time trying to come up with reasons that might exonerate someone as much as I have with Braun. The majority of people who examine this case believe that Braun either played a role in the disappearance or knows more than she has shared. Unfortunately, whatever evidence is necessary to prove this, or to cause her to share what she may know, remains to be found. It seems likely that one of the women in Jeremy's life knows what happened to him, and at this point in time, Braun is the only one left who can still talk if the circumstances are right. After the release of last week's episode, I had a small conversation with Jeremy's mother, Cheryl. While I'm no detective, I do hope that these episodes have done the story justice, and if nothing else, can help spread Jeremy's story and keep his name alive in hopes that someone, somewhere, will hear this and come forward. Jeremy Burt has been missing for 11 years. It's undeniable that someone knows the truth and has remained silent all this time. This individual, or group of persons, whoever they may be, possess the ability to solve this mystery and to help end the grief and bring closure to a family which has been irreparably damaged. When a family member is murdered, it's a horrifying and heartbreaking occurrence, but it does provide some closure. You know what happened, you know where your loved one is. For the Burt family and Jeremy's own daughter, they don't possess this information. There's no grave or memorial they can visit. There's no certainty in knowing what happened, and there's no justice for whoever was responsible. Someone knows the truth, and perhaps that person is even listening right now. We can only hope that someone will come forward, or some new piece of evidence will be recovered, and this mystery will be solved. Until that day, the disappearance of Jeremy Burt remains open, unsolved, and cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Jeremy Burt, there are many websites and forums which discuss his case. The Facebook page, Jeremy Carl Burt is Missing, provides a lot of information, as does the Facebook page, Idaho Cold Cases. Both Disappeared and Dateline did episodes about Jeremy's case. If you have any information about the disappearance of Jeremy Burt, please contact the Boise Police Department at 208-570-6290. You can also contact private investigator Marky Davis at 801-719-9494. You may remain anonymous if you wish to reveal information. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod. Message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. I want to give a special shout out to Patreon producers Krista Colvin, Diane Dyson, Kate Alexander, Lucy LaRue, Lynn Merschel, and Sarah Burrow. Make sure you check your emails, as I'm awaiting responses from several of you regarding your trace evidence gear. Your support makes this show possible. If you're interested in supporting trace evidence, visit patreon.com/traceevidence. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings and reviews the show gets, the more people are able to hear these unsolved cases. For more information about other cases, transcripts, media, and more, please visit the website at trace-evidence.com. I want to thank all of you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
I'm Mo Blackwell, the host of Targeted, True Crime, Domestic Violence. We'll investigate one case of family violence each season using academic research to interpret the events so that we can become better advocates. Join us as we spotlight the death of 4-year-old Melissa Gibson from her stepfather's abuse, delve into her family situation, break down the trial of her parents, and examine how her murder in 1976 led to changes in social service departments around the United States. Is there something we can learn about family violence through examining her murder? I think there is. She wasn't the only one in the house who was being abused.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.